Case this morning is case number 70402, Mott versus Mott. Council, you ready to proceed? And did you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, please, Your Honor. I would like 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
2.5, you got it.
May it please the court, my name is Shan Winesett, representing Stacy Mott, now known as Stacy Torrey. The couple undisputed facts that we're dealing with is that the father terminated his parental rights over 9 years before he sought to set it aside. He did that within a divorce decree.
But if you can't do it within a divorce decree, where does that leave us?
Well, I guess that would lead to what we spent most of the time in our brief looking at, and that is this court's holding in Harrison Living Trust, in which the court specifically outlined that you, even if you have a void judgment, you can't sit on your rights for years and expect to be able to be relieved of that judgment. The court said there is no reason to ignore the express language of a rule that requires the district courts to consider the timeliness of the motion to set aside a void judgment when determining.
Counsel, do we have a valid judgment since they didn't finish it? We have a stip that got signed, but no order.
Well, that, Your Honor, is Justice Douglas, you're referring to the stipulation, the petition for adoption, the decree of adoption?
In both parts, we have a problem in terms of having a final order.
Well, in this particular case, the court issued a decree terminating the parental rights, so there is an actual order. And the father manifested his intent to have that order deemed valid.
I think that's clear from the record on that point that, yes, the father did agree at the time of the divorce and get it done. I guess the legal problem, Judge Moss concluded she inadvertently signed the decree containing that provision because you have to do the termination. It has to be a separate proceeding with notice of all that, and that didn't happen. So, like you said, the issue now is, does this delay based on equity preclude the father from making this claim at this stage? And that would lead me to the question that Justice Douglas was alluding to. We don't have a valid procedure from the inception here. Can that delay be invoked? Judge Moss said no. You know, she allowed the father continue to have his parental rights, and so why do you think she's wrong, and how did she abuse her discretion in making that ruling?
The reason why I believe she abused her discretion, Justice Gibbons, is that there was a decree that terminated the rights. There was an actual order. Now, this court has determined that order is void. There's still something that needs to be done with it, and if someone acts as if a void judgment is valid, and they manifest their intent to abide by that judgment. And in this case, the manifestation of the intent was the father did not pay any child support for a decade. The amount that would have accrued had he not done that would have been approximately $140,000. So the father manifested his intent. The second part to that, in the restatement that's referenced in the paperwork 66, is that there's also, when you're dealing with familial relationships, the longer that you let those go, the more everybody relies on this. The children have taken the name of Mr. Torrey. They have their social security cards are in that name. They have held out to the world that they were adopted. In fact, Judge Thompson, the district court, issued an adoption order. So there are third parties that have relied upon Mr. Mott's acceptance of this order terminating his rights. And to have Judge Moss then unwind a decade's worth of familial relationships and the childhood of the children in a long motion calendar on an order shortening time without taking in evidence, I would submit to this court as an abuse of discretion.
I think we agree, we understand the practical issues and emotional issues with the children and Mrs. Mott's remarried and how disruptive this would be to her life, her husband's, the child. We get all that on the thing, and we understand that. So I don't think that's the problem. The question is, as a matter of law, can you apply these equitable principles that you're asserting in this type of situation if the original order in the divorce decree is void as a matter of law? That's the unusual issue we're getting here in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe the Harrison Living Trust that this court issued is a perfect base for these arguments, because in that case it was a void order that the court said, well, it's a void order, it shouldn't be enforced. But you, in this case, in Harrison Living Trust, it was only 2 years that the judgment debtor sat on their rights. Here we've got 9 years of sitting on your rights. Additionally, there are two cases that we cited in our fast track statement. One was from the Tennessee Supreme Court, and the other was from the Texas Supreme Court, dealing with the same issue. In that case, a termination was entered without notice to the mother in both cases. And in those cases, one of them, the mother waited for 8 years to go back. And on the exact same equitable doctrines that this court espoused in Harrison Living Trust, the court said, you know what? We're going to say, yes, the judgment terminating the rights is void because of lack of notice. There's no subject matter jurisdiction to issue that order. However, we're sending this case back to the trial court to determine whether there was detrimental reliance and whether the parent manifested an intent to adhere to the terms of that judgment. And specifically, the interesting thing is that the case is on point where the Supreme Court said to do is to look at the child support that was waived during that period. And that's kind of what we have here. And
Mr. Weissman?
Are we to just totally disregard the public policy set forth by IRS 128 as to formality and child's best interest and the father being there for prove up to say yes, no, whatever? And
no, we're not ignoring that, Your Honor, because we've kind of gone beyond that to what happens when you have a father that waits a decade before he determines he wants to do something about the fact that he terminated his parental rights.
Well, if we're going to go to that point, say he waited a decade, with some intervening facts as to why he's not coming forth in terms of the children being placed in, taken away from for a period of time.
That's exactly right, Justice Douglas.
That comes back to the best interest of the children, does it not?
Yes, it does, but there was no evidentiary hearing conducted by the lower court. There wasn't even a reference, as I recall, in the order regarding best interest. It just said, well,
that terminating. The point of the original proceeding, that was not taken into consideration in what manifests itself as a proceeding that does not comport with 128.
Correct. And by the same token, if we use 128 as an analogy, there's a statute in 128 in which the person trying to reestablish the parental rights is required to go through, and the court is required to have a hearing and conduct a best interest analysis. And again, Judge Moss
did not do that. They didn't do it in the first place when they purportedly terminated.
No.
This one more step.
That is correct, Justice Douglas. But I would also remind the court that parents terminate their parental rights all the time. And so even if 128 was not adhered to strictly, we do have situations that parents will consent to adoptions. They will consent to the termination of their parental rights because they recognize they can't take care of the children, which is exactly what Mr. Mock did 10 years ago, as he recognized during that time that he couldn't. And so when you're doing an adoption and you have a consent, the court's not necessarily doing an intense investigation of the best interest. So at some point when parents relinquish their rights, and in this case it was done formally in a decree, that again, there you manifest the intent to abide by that.
Mr. Weinstein, the original hearing, Mr. Mott was noticed that hearing was going to occur. He knew the issue of parental termination was going to be taken up because he had stipulated to that. Why wasn't that hearing where he determined he waived his appearance and didn't show up, why isn't that hearing sufficient to satisfy 128? Are you satisfied that the initial finding terminating his parental rights is wrong? I mean, are you conceding that, or are you arguing?
No, I just kind of jumped to my argument because it seemed like the court had already made its determination in that regard. So I focused on the equitable issues in the Harris Living Trust precedent. But Justice Stiglitz, you are correct that the court did actually canvass the mother during that time. And various important questions were asked. Can you take care of the children without support of the government? Do you believe that the termination is in the best interest of the child? And those answers were correct. And in the decree, you will find that there is a finding by the court that it was in the best interest of the children. And again, that's no different than a summary adoption proceeding. And I anticipate the argument's going to be that you should never allow parents to stipulate to terminate their parental rights because then you deprive the child of two parents. That's inconsistent with our adoption paradigm where a single parent can adopt a child. So in the experience through family court, sometimes it is in the best interest for the children that one parent exit the relationship. For whatever reason, it's failure to adjust, abandonment, other issues, that type of thing.
What happened to the decree of adoption? What happened to it?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Has it been filed since?
No, nothing. To my knowledge, once Judge Moss issued her order, nothing happened.
How did the kids get Social Security cards since their birth certificates say Mott?
I don't know, Your Honor. I do not know how that happened. But I do know that they held the children out as their own. Both Mr. Torrey held the children out as well. And that's even admitted in the filings of Mr. Mott that they did so. How their documents were changed, I just don't know.
How did they discover that it hadn't been filed?
I do not know that either, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd like to, the Chief's still asking.
Yes.
I'd like to explore the consideration you've urged on the court that we adopt Tennessee and Texas approach to this, which, as I understand it, results in a remand for further hearing. The question then is, what's the remedy at the district court level? You remand, what is the court to look at? Only the question about estoppel, so to speak, and so then what is the father's parental rights? Do they go unterminated? Yet I don't know where that leaves us. What is the remedy on remand?
Well, I think one thing
seems to me that we're opening the door for even more uncertainty in all of this, and I'd like to try to get some clarity as to what a remand would produce.
Well, a remand would produce a full vetting of the facts to the trial court of what happened.
But would it take the parties back to, okay, this is what they agreed to do at the time of the divorce, so now we're going to do it correctly? Or do the facts mean that we're going to take a look at what's happened in the ensuing 9 years and evaluate the outcome based upon what's in the best interest of the children? Or are we going to, I'm not quite sure, how would we instruct the district court to examine this on remand?
I think, Justice Hardesty, what happened and transpired and what's in the best interest of the children is definitely a consideration.
Would we be examining that in the context of the period when the divorce was originally entered, or would we be examining that in the context of today?
In the context of today, the court would be considering the first of all, the manifestation of intent and the benefits that the father derived from not asserting the rights for a decade. It would also go to the reliance of third parties on his manifestation to have his parental rights terminated. So it would be everything after that, and it would require the court to consider the best interest, again, which is something that Judge Moss did not do.
At the end of the day, let's assume that the court concludes that the best interests of the children are to remain with mom. Does the father have any visitation rights? His parenting apparently is not terminated. What then? Does he have an obligation to pay child support prospectively? I mean,
I would say that
it seems to me that there's a lot of other issues once you say that his parenting rights have not been terminated.
I would agree with that, but I believe that that is an inquiry that needs to be made regardless of what kind of other issues are going to arise, and it's certainly something the district court did not do. And in the ultimately, if the district court determines that he essentially waived or equitable principles deprive him of setting aside that termination, then that termination should remain, regardless if it's a void judgment.
Well, one of the remedies would be to retain the termination.
Absolutely. Just like, as I understand, the court did in the Harris Living Trust case.
May I ask a question? I know we're over time. You said something that escaped my attention in preparing, and that was the summary nature of how this proceeded in district court. You had a motion to reinstate parental rights. Is that what was filed by your friend on the other side?
It was under Rule 60B to...
60B-4 saying it was void, right?
Yes.
And then that was filed on the motion for order shortening time?
Correct.
And how much time did you have to oppose this?
I was not the trial court. I believe it was just a few days.
Okay, so a cursory opposition was filed. Then what happened?
And then the court held a hearing, and then the
was
court...
Was it an evidentiary hearing?
No. It was a long motion calendar. I believe it was about 45 minutes, if I recall the record correctly, maybe an hour. And the court determined that it would not get to the issue of the timeliness of the deal because she thought that as a matter of law, she needed to change her ruling.
So there was no evidentiary presentation of equitable issues that you've outlined at all?
At all. Not at all. And in fact, the Stacy was on the telephone and she attempted to say something to the effect that's not true, and the court said, ma'am, we're not getting to that. So there was really no opportunity there was not a single document introduced in evidence. There was not a single witness examined or cross-examined. Nothing.
What kind of briefing was there, for example, on the point that Justice Stiglitz raises and that you allude to, that why wouldn't we treat this original decree as, in essence, a species of adoption order or a consent, and the notice that he had that of the decree being entered would be sufficient? I mean, none of that was explored then?
At the trial court level?
Yeah.
No.
So you want us to come and... I mean, that for us to get into this, we have to do this afresh, essentially, because there's such a small record here, right?
That would be correct.
Okay.
There is not a large record. The order's not very long. There are not findings of fact. And it was
no evidentiary tender of any kind?
None. There were the documents that were submitted as exhibits weren't even authenticated. There was no opportunity for either side to actually present their evidence.
Why couldn't the judge, looking at the decree that she signed previously, make those legal determinations, knowing that the formalities weren't complied with, and essentially setting it aside, saying it was improper, it didn't comply with the law, and therefore it's void.
I'm sorry, Justice Paragay, I didn't understand the question.
I'm saying, why can't the judge, and isn't it a legal issue that the judge could take a look at the order that she had prepared and say it's completely inadequate, it doesn't follow the formalities, and it's void for that reason?
I don't think there's any legal impediment to her doing that.
And what other testimony would be necessary if it was a legal determination that the formalities weren't followed, and that's the reason I'm setting it aside.
Because if the determination is a void order, then we get into the Harrison Living Trust equitable principles of what you do when you've got 10 years of life and the lives of these children, and people relying on someone having terminated their rights in a document that's entered, then we get into that situation that we were, that's
that, and that, you say they didn't have an opportunity to argue.
They did not have an opportunity to present evidence. That hearing was on an order shortening time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
Morning, Justices. May it please the Court. Joey Mott for Respondent Justin Mott.
Mr. Mott, can I ask you a couple questions?
Please.
Since I know, well, I'm sure there'll be a lot of them with my colleagues. Taking the other side of the coin from what I asked Mr. Wine said, that my concern here is that your client did agree to the termination in the divorce, whether it was legally proper or not, I guess we'll have to decide. But he did, and he had all these years where he didn't pay child support. If, for example, if he wasn't terminated in the decree and then he chose not to pay child support, Mrs. Maud, now Mrs. Torrey, could have filed a termination petition against him after, I believe, 3 years for not paying child support, terminated his parental rights if he, unless, you know, he paid what he's supposed to pay, and then done the adoption. So she's kind of been sandbagged on this whole thing. He agreed to this. He hasn't paid anything. It certainly isn't fair to go 9 years, in my view, without paying child support. And also, how do we deal with that piece of the case, assuming we have a right to go into these equitable issues?
Yeah. First, I don't think the child support issue is before the court today. I don't think we get there today.
Okay.
If this court does, in fact, affirm Judge Moss's decision, well, then we'll probably end up dealing with that child support issue. And if that time comes, we welcome that opportunity. But as I stated in the briefing, Mr. Mott would never in any way trade $1,000 a month for the right to...
Why he agreed to the divorce with the termination in the first place?
Well, the facts there are hazy, but my understanding and my knowledge based on talking to several people is that he was intoxicated at the time he signed the decree. And in fact, it's interesting to note that...
Rule 60b-4 says a reasonable time. I get that it's not in the 6 months as some of the subsections, but if you're claiming a judgment or an order is void, you have to bring your motion within a reasonable time. And it would seem to me if this was entered on the strength of something he signed while he was intoxicated, he got notice of the hearing, correct?
He did have notice of the hearing.
And he waited 9 years or 8 years before he moved to set it aside?
That's correct.
How is that reasonable?
Well, first of all, it's reasonable because he had no idea that he had an option other than to abide by the termination. He felt like he made a grievous error, he made a huge mistake, and he was stuck with it.
How do we know that?
I'm sorry?
How do we know that?
I'm telling you that. And there,
what evidence?
That was in the briefing at the district court, yes.
Was there an affidavit to that effect?
I don't believe there was an affidavit to that effect.
Were any witnesses sworn before the district court?
No. But I think we're putting the cart before the horse a little bit because I don't think we even get to the evidentiary issues because Judge Moss, the standard review today is abuse of discretion. Judge Moss did not abuse her discretion. She weighed these things. She weighed the reasonableness of time. The record at...
That's the concern, counsel, is the record.
Sure.
Was there a sufficient record for a judge to make a reasonable exercise of discretion below? And if we had no witnesses, we had no affidavits, what was actually tendered to the court that says what was done previously was inappropriate? Was it just merely a legal argument as to formalities under 128, or what was it?
Yeah, and I think the question that I should address is this a legal or factual issue? And I believe it's purely a legal issue at this point because...
But Rule 60b-4 itself recognizes judgments are entered that are void, right?
Correct.
You're saying this judgment was void. Even so, if you want to unsettle the settled expectations created by a judgment, you have to bring a motion within a reasonable time. That's an issue of fact. I'm really struggling, and I'm not trying to give you a hard time,
no,
but I'm struggling to understand how you could make that factual determination on a motion that comes 9 years after the judgment, that this was a reasonable time on an order shortening time, no evidentiary hearing, no evidence attached to the motion. Help me out here.
Sure. To clarify a little bit, we're not, as the court knows, we're not talking about a run-of-the-mill order, a run-of-the-mill judgment. This case deals with what this court has called the civil death penalty, with what this court has called an extraordinary exercise of authority over a parent. This is not an ordinary circumstance. This is an extraordinary circumstance. To that, I will agree with them. There is an extraordinary circumstance here. It's that my client had his rights revoked outside of compliance with the strict guidelines set forth by the Nevada legislature. If the legislature intended for some other method under which parental rights could be terminated, well, that would be the law. But the law that we have is NRS 128 that says unequivocally, I don't think anybody disputes the clear language there that says only where the dictates of this chapter are complied with can rights be terminated.
Well, Mr. Ma,
sure.
How long are you suggesting would be a reasonable amount of time? So you say 9 years, that's fine. 10 years, 12 years? At what point is it unreasonable for him to let that stand? What happened in the first year, the second year, the third year?
And he, my understanding is he explored it along the way and didn't know that he had any option. And then the way it came about, and this is not in the briefing, but it might be insightful for the court, is he learned of the violation of that law as a result of proceedings in a Utah court where the Utah district attorney said there was a violation of the law. And that's what sparked him to ask me to investigate it. I looked at it, determined, yeah, there was, in fact, a violation of the law on the termination. And that's how we got there. And that's the reason for the delay. Whether 9 years is too long, that was Judge Moss's decision to make. And in the record, if we go to, and I resent a little bit that petitioners frame this as though it wasn't discussed at all at the district court level, because nearly the entire argument was based on the delay. And in fact, at one point, Mr. Friedman said, but Judge, have they waived that defect by coming 9 years later? The judge recognized that and says, yep, I appreciate that. There's an estoppel issue, and that's something I have to consider. She goes on in her ruling to say, and we've got a length of time of 9 years. That is discretionary within the court, whether that's too long or not. And she says, in some cases, I had one in Michigan that was 10 years. I've had others that were 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and I have decided whether to let it go. And she weighed that. She decided that in this circumstance, with a violation of the law, that 9 years was not unreasonable. And the precedent brought forth by...
So is the rule every time one of these occurs, it's always subject to being set aside because it violates the law?
I would argue that where the law is violated, there is not a valid order. Yes.
Right, but Rule 60b-4 says it addresses a void judgment. There isn't some super void status.
No,
and it still requires a reasonable time. At some point, the interest in having matters settled, according to the rules of civil procedure at least, trump whatever may have gone wrong in the entry of the original order, unless there's fraud or
And in keeping with this court's analogy that it's the civil death penalty, if you had a convict before you who was sentenced to death and you determined that his sentencing was a violation of the law, would you let that stand for the sake of having
finality? So you would just,
finality?
For family law, read the reasonable time requirement out of 60b-4 in the termination setting?
In fact, I think in the termination setting, that would be appropriate. And the precedent brought forward from the Texas court and the Tennessee court, those are very different circumstances. Those are procedural deficiencies. Those are notice issues. Those are the veil issue goes to void or voidable. That's an issue of a question of residency for the parent. This is a very unique circumstance where the district court admits now that it violated Nevada law in terminating my client's parental rights. And that's not something that this court can countenance. A violation of the law is a violation of the law, whether it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And it is unique in the family court circumstance because obviously when children reach the age of majority, things change. And here we have an 18-year-old, a 17-year-old who will be 18 in 2 months, I think, and a 15-year-old. The other issue we have is that there's nowhere else for them to go. Mom doesn't have rights to the children right now because she's lost custody of the children as a result of being found guilty of abuse. She's currently facing trial.
Sir, are these on the record? Are these references you're making
in
the record?
Those references are on the record, ma'am. Yes.
Where? Go ahead.
I can pull them up. if the court would like. Otherwise, she has been found guilty of child abuse. She's currently on trial for felony child abuse, and her husband, the purported adopted father, is on trial for rape.
Can I lodge an objection to this? Because the court excluded specific things. This court was required to focus on what was before Judge Moss at that time. There were documents that have not been authenticated, that have been submitted to this court, that are rogue documents, that are not there. I do not know.
You know what? I'd like some supplemental briefing on this issue before I try to make a decision as chief. I'll give you each a chance to supplemental brief on the issue of the child abuse and the pending trial.
Thank you.
Let's do that. If you could get it to us within about, if you could file it with the, I'd like blind briefs on this. Each of you get a supplemental briefing within 2 weeks.
And just to make sure I'm clear.
Just on this issue, his objection as to whether this court should consider the fact that there's, that you stand in trial for child abuse and the other allegations that you've made against the.
Okay.
I'd also like to have addressed, he indicated that a bunch of rogue documents, were those subjected to at any time? And that I just want addressed in the supplement.
They were stricken by this court.
Right. There were documents that were attached that weren't a part of the record at the district court level that were
stricken,
taken out of this record, correct? Yeah, they were after. In fact, they were documents created after this.
What's relevant, please?
What's in the record?
Yeah, what's in the record?
In our record.
In the district court record as to what happened with Judge Moss on these issues. You said that there was that this was raised in the district court. You said it's part of the record that we've got now.
Yes. It is. These issues were raised. The abuse of the children was raised at the district court level. The mother's, at that point, was in a family court setting in Utah, and I'm not exactly familiar with the organization of their courts, but at the time of the briefing in this case, she had been adjudicated guilty of child abuse by the Utah court.
Is there a certified judgment of conviction in the district court record in Nevada?
I would have to look, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence of what you're talking about in the district court record?
There are. There are petitions filed by the Utah District Attorney's Office and the Attorney General outlining the allegations of abuse.
And are those filed? Were those filed in the case before Judge Moss?
They were, Your Honor.
Okay. And that was before her when she rendered her determination?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was partially the impetus for this entire situation, is that mom had lost custody of the kids, and the kids had nowhere to go, essentially. And so my client, learning that there was a violation of the law in terminating his rights, was obviously interested in remedying that, if at all possible. Currently, the kids are in my client's custody. The 18-year-old is out of the house. He's of majority now. But the children have been living there.
Mr. Mott?
Yes, sir.
If I could, do you agree that, because apparently you all talked a lot in the district court about estoppel. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a lot of time was devoted to that, and that appears to be so in the transcript. My concern is that there's no mention of any of that or how the court addressed it in its order. And so I had asked some questions of counsel about this court's adoption of the approach taken in Tennessee and Texas, where a remand was directed, and that these issues would be more thoroughly vetted in an evidentiary hearing leading to findings. What's your view about that? I know you don't want a remand, and I know you'd just as soon proceed on the basis of the order you now have, but just the dialogue that's taken place here in the well suggests to me that some of these issues around equitable estoppel should have at least been included in Judge Moss's order, whether she was addressing the reasonableness of the 60B application, or whether she was addressing the equitable estoppel issues under Harrison or the Tennessee and Texas cases.
Sure, Your Honor. And I think to go to your point earlier, when Mr. Weinstein was arguing, a remand here does not lead to clarity. A remand leads to more confusion.
I don't doubt that.
Compliance with the law leads to clarity. Yeah. And here there is an unequivocal, unquestionable violation of Nevada law on the termination of rights. And so on remand...
Well, but I think the lack of clarity is still present, even though your client's rights would be restored under the order. We're still in some uncertainty here because we don't know whether he's supposed to pay support or not. We don't know lots of questions, and presumably that has to still be adjudicated in the district court. So the lack of clarity is present whether this is remanded or not. Would you agree with that?
I would agree the lack of clarity on other issues is relevant, but not as to the termination. I think the other issues come later. If in fact this court upholds Judge Moss's decision, can I answer?
Yes.
If this court,
yeah, of course.
If this court upholds Judge Moss's decision, well then we can go back and Ms. Torrey can litigate those issues before the district court in light of my client having his rights restored and in light of the initial order being void. And that's the opportunity that would be appropriate. That's the clarification that would be appropriate, clarifying those issues in light of a ruling on the termination. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes,
may I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Mott, except as the impetus for what caused the other Mr. Mott to get involved, what legal relevance do these abuse claims have at all on the issues that this court is going to decide, whether or not the original hearing was the termination was okay, and whether or not the adoption with that technical or procedural error should be recognized?
To the extent that, well, I didn't plan to address those issues at all today. Mr. Weinstedt brought up the point that familial relationships would be impacted. The court asked about those issues to him as well. I think those demonstrate that those are not valid concerns. Damage to familial relationships, well, there are no familial relationships there at this point. Or I shouldn't say there are none. There obviously are. There are significantly damaged familial relationships. This is not like my clients showing up 9 years later and swooping in to Beaver Cleaver's house and saying, I'm here to get my rights back. That's simply not what happened. What happened is these children were in foster care.
So then in the absence of these abuse allegations, you would agree that the client coming in 9 years later would be problematic?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Okay. Right,
your time's up, yes.
Yes, it is.
Let me tell you what we're going to do. When we conference, you'll get an order from the court as to exactly if there's going to be supplemental briefing and what it would entail. We'll be very clear in that. We'll work on that in conference as to what we should do from here. I don't think that it's appropriate to submit the case at this time because we're going to get the supplemental briefing, I think. If we don't get the supplemental, if we decide not to get supplemental briefing and just decide the case, then this case will stand submitted at this time. I'm trying to be as clear as possible to both of you.
Here's the problem. A prior order of the court is stricken, the appendix on which Mr. Mott relies.
Well, we don't know. We don't know yet. That we don't know what was stricken.
Once it's stricken, we don't have it.
Right. Yeah, well, that's why I'd be very clear. But we'll write an appropriate order at this time.
If it's helpful, I don't contest that those documents are not properly before this court. There's an error for me to file them when they were stricken. I concede that those documents that were not a part of the district court record.
We're concerned what happened in the district court.
I appreciate that. Okay. And I concede that.
To the court, those documents didn't exist at the time Judge Moss ran.
Okay. Well, we'll look just to see what Judge Moss did in the court, okay? We'll be very clear with that.
Chief, can I ask Mr. Weinstein one question? When you filed the notice of appeal and the record on appeal, did you attach the video disc of the proceedings in district court? Are they part of the record?
I don't think so because we rely on
the written.
I don't know the answer to that, but I believe we submit the transcript.
Okay.
Is it required by the rule to submit a video?
Well, that's a good question. So, but anyway, but you did submit a transcript of the. We got the court order signed by Judge Moss, so we have that. My question is, if the video was transcripted in the district court, if you submitted the transcript, then that's my question.
We'll, at the joint appendix at page 196, the court will find the transcript of.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both for trying to instill on us what exactly happened. And we'll be back in touch with you, definitely with an order, one way or the other. Okay? And this court, the inbound court, is now in recess until April 4th, when we will meet at our new home in Las Vegas. Thank you.